So, first of all, good morning. It's great to see everyone. And the topic this morning is about lessons learned from the great sage in the times of the Mishnah and the Talmud, one of the greatest teachers Israel ever knew, a man named Rabbi Akiva, who had a remarkable life. But before I talk about that, I want to just share an incredibly powerful idea. It was powerful to me. And it was something that I heard from my mom. So what was unique about my parents' community in New York, I think it was the first Jewish community in the country that had been significantly affected by the coronavirus. It was in the news for at least a week and a half, 2 weeks straight. It's called New Rochelle in Westchester, New York. The National Guard took over the city. My dad's shul, the Young Israel, the synagogue called the Young Israel of New Rochelle, was in the New York Times, and thank God now they're getting a lot of good publicity, where that was the first community in mass to come together to donate plasma, which had antibodies to help others who were suffering from the virus. But something that I heard from my mom had the virus. She was probably knocked out for about 2 weeks. She wasn't seriously ill. She wasn't in the hospital, but she was incapacitated for a while. And what she said was as follows. She said, that in life, there are so many projects that we work on, endeavors that we engage in. And then we plan them and we run them, we execute them, and we have a tendency to look back afterwards, the morning after or even that night, and we reflect on how it went down. We try to assess how successful it was. And our tendency sometimes is to focus on all of the things that went wrong. It could be that 99% of everything went perfect and smooth, but our tendency is to harp on those things that didn't go exactly as we had hoped for. That's me. It's one of my greatest flaws that I am a perfectionist. I guess that has a strength too, is that you try to get things right. But when you don't get right, I will only see the components that didn't go the way I wanted.
Excuse me, you're
And
pixelating. I don't know why. Is
I
that
am
happening with
pixelating.
everyone?
I'm kind of feeling it. Woo, it feels a little funny. No, I'm guessing that something is up with my internet connection, and I hope that I stop pixelating soon. But I don't know that I could do anything about that. Flo, am I still pixelating? I can't hear you, Flo. You gotta unmute.
I'm going to go like this. The other day it happened too. Sometimes the voice gets so cut off. I don't know if that's happening with anybody else. Maybe they can raise their hand, but.
Okay.
All right, yeah. So if there's ever an issue, just raise your hand or give me a signal so I know that the worst thing is if you go on, sure, we've all had this experience where you're on the phone and you're on this very long monologue, a soliloquy, and then 5 minutes in, you realize the phone is dead. There's nobody listening, and you want to know exactly at what point did you stop hearing me? This is. But anyway, just to go back to my mom's point is that in today's times, what we're going through now, where get online to get into a store, and then when you finally get into the store, half of the products you hope to purchase are no longer available for sale. We feel secluded. We feel a little bit alone. It's not easy times. Worry about what the financial future has, what our health has in store for us, loved ones, people we know who are sick. There's so much to worry about. And in order to stay sane, we need to focus on the positive. We have to look at what the positive that we have and thank God we are also fortunate. Was it last? I think it was last Monday morning. Last Monday was a Tuesday morning. We woke up and the heat broke. There was no heat in the home. And thank God, about within 4 hours, the repairman was there and had it fixed. But then you start to appreciate that it's warm, 38 degrees outside. Or you appreciate the fact that you have food to eat. It's you must buy food. It's not because we have no food left at all. Thank God our pantries are pretty decently stocked. and you focus on the positive that we have. And so we got to look a little harder in today's times to find that positive, but we're going to. We're going to find a lot of what's in our lives. And my mom's message was that if in the past, despite the overwhelming positivity, we had a tendency to focus on the negative, on the things that went wrong, now we're going to train ourselves to focus on that which is good. And hopefully we're going to learn how to do that so that when life resumes and is restored to normal, we are going to feel surrounded, inundated, and flooded by so much positive. We will be focused on the deficiency of things that have gone wrong. So that's just, I feel, a message of positivity. That being said, let's go back to the theme of today's class, which is focusing on the story of Rabbi Akiva. I want to fast forward to come back to the beginning of his life, but I want to fast forward to the end of his life. And Rabbi Akiva died a couple of times. And I want to read with you the account in the Talmud. As the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, puts it, it's in tractate, the very first tractate in the Talmud. And it says as follows. It says, one time, the wicked government, which meant the Roman government, which had persecuted our people so horrifically, they decreed that Israel not allowed to engage in the study of Torah. You see, the Romans maybe were a cruel people, but they were smart, they were brilliant, and they understood that the secret to our prolonged existence was the fact that we had this book called the Torah that we studied. I just got a message on the chat from one of the participants saying that the audio is not so clear.
It is not clear. You're pixelating. I was waiting, looking at people's reactions if it was anybody else, but.
Okay.
Is it everybody else? Yeah, okay. I'm looking at people.
What I want to do. I want to pause for a moment. I'm going to try to change locations in my home to a place that may have a stronger internet connection. So bear with me. I'm going to stop my video.
There, it's really perfect.
What's that?
This sounds perfect for a second, and then you.
Okay, but I haven't changed it. So I'm going to change locations. Bear with me,
okay? Okay. Hi, Faith. I unmuted myself. We could all unmute till he comes back.
Hi, Flo. How are you?
Fine. Good to see you.
Hi, Flo. It's Sherry. Everybody doing healthy?
Yeah. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Jerry, unmute.
I can't get the Zoom. What's the Zoom number? I just have the phone number. What's the Zoom number?
It was in the email that Carol sent.
How do I get to you? What do I press?
Okay, I could give you the Zoom number. The Zoom number is as follows. Meeting number 715-200-157.
But how do I get onto the first number? I mean, that's the ID number, right?
Correct. So that should be the only number you need. You should be able to go to Zoom.com, and that number is the meeting number that should get you into this meeting.
Zoom.com.
You should be able to.
Onto my computer.
Did you get an email?
An email from Mommy Misad?
From Carol Horton.
Do you have the Zoom app?
No.
Who's talking that didn't get an email?
Yeah, you need the Zoom app in order to video. You can call on the phone and you can hear, but you can't see unless you have the Zoom app.
Oh, I don't care to see. I just want to hear.
Well, we hear you.
But I just have the telephone. I don't want it on the telephone. I want it on the on my computer.
Then you have to have the Zoom app on your computer.
I have Mama Miss. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Okay. I don't want to
disturb anyone. Is the image any better? Is the audio any clearer?
The audio sounds very clear.
Yeah.
Very clear.
And we have some nice pictures behind you.
Excellent. Hopefully. Very good. Great.
Thank you.
Okay, so we shall continue. We are at the end of Rabbi Akiva's life. And the Romans forbade the study of Torah. And it says that there was a man, and his name was Pappus ben Yehuda. In Jewish history, whenever they wanted to give a person a name, they always used your name and then the person's parent name. That was the way of identification. So Pappus ben Yehuda means Pappus, the son of Yehuda. And he found Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was undeterred. And he was publicly gathering together groups of students, teaching them Torah. And this Pappus says, Rabbi Akiva, are you not afraid of the government, the Romans? If they find you, they may kill you. And Rabbi Akiva answered with a very famous parable. Just let me give you a parable, a story. To what could we compare this fear of yours? He says, you know, let's imagine that there was a fox walking along the riverbank. And the fox was rather hungry. He hadn't had his breakfast that morning. And also very sly, the slyest of all the animals. And he sees a fish swimming in the river. And the fox says to the fish, you know, I saw some fishermen upstream. They're heading our way. They're going to be looking for you in the water. You are not safe, he tells the fish, in the water. You need to come sit here with me on the river bank. They're never going to look for you over here. And the fish responded to the fox saying, are you the one they call the wisest of all the beasts? You don't seem to be wise, but rather foolish. Because in a place that it is suited for my survival, the water, perhaps I will live, perhaps the fishermen will catch me and I will die. But if I come and sit next to you on the riverbank for a fish who needs water to breathe through his gills, it is certain death. And Rabbi Akiva turned to his students and he said, you know, for the Jews, if we continue to study Torah, we may live, we may not get caught, we may die, the Romans may catch us. We stop, we desist from studying Torah for the Jewish people at the end of us. We continue to study Torah. Not many days pass, says the Talmud, and they caught, the Romans caught Rabbi Akiva, and they put him in jail. In the cell next to him was this very man, Pappus, the son of Yehuda. And he says to Akiva, fortunate are you because you were placed here in jail because of teaching Torah. I was placed here for trivial matters. At the time, they were taking Rabbi Akiva out to execute him. They killed him in the cruelest way. They began to comb off his skin with iron combs. And that's how they began to kill him. And at that point, Rabbi Akiva began to recite the Shema. Shema Yisrael, he said. And his students, seeing his incredible devotion, said, Rebbe, teacher, even to this extent? And he said to them, my entire life, it bothered me. When could I fulfill this verse in the Shema, which says that one must serve God with all of their assets and with even their very soul, even if God were to take their soul? I was worried, when would I fulfill that verse? And now I am worthy, I am fortunate to fulfill this verse of serving God even with my very soul. And Rabbi Akiva was pronouncing that final word of Echad, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And as he was saying that last word, Echad, that is when his soul departed from his body. And the angel said, fortunate are you, Akiva, that your soul departs with the word Echad. That was the end of his life. And there are two messages, two lessons that I feel are very important to take from this story. Number one is that Rabbi Akiva saw life as a mission. He saw it as an opportunity to accomplish something great. And therefore, you know, this was high up on his list. When could I show my total devotion to Hashem, to God? You know, he lived his life developing his close connection to the Almighty. Every day involved, engaged in the service of Hashem. But he asked himself, am I really up there? Have I really accomplished that incredible devotion? It's like a soldier. You know, you're in basic training. And you train and you train and you train. And you say, I've learned so much, but when I'm going to be placed on those front lines, how will I react? Is all my training really making me the soldier that I hope to be? And the only way you could ever really know it is when there are bullets whizzing past your head. Are you going to cower up in some corner and hide? Or are you going to be brave and courageous and charge into battle? Reminds me of a joke I heard when I was younger. This is like one of our family's favorite jokes. And it was a man who dreamed of Broadway. He always had a strong theatrical side. And his dream was to make it onto Broadway. And he always starred in his high school productions. And even in college, he always, you know, he was majoring in theater. And finally, they call him. They're going to give him a very small part. But it's a part in Broadway nonetheless. And the way it's going to go is there's going to be a cannon go boom. And he's going to say, hark, I hear the cannons roar. And he's practicing. He's practicing for weeks with different intonations. Hark, I hear the cannons roar. Hark, I hear the cannons roar. He's practicing and practicing and practicing. And finally, the big day comes and he's on stage. And the cannons go, boom! And he goes, whoa, what was that? And he blew it. He practiced and he practiced and he practiced. But when they went boom, he didn't say his line. And a soldier also has to ask that question, I've been practicing and practicing, but what will happen when I see combat? And Rabbi Akiva had been dedicating his life to the service of the Almighty, forging a really strong relationship with Hashem. And he asked himself the question, when the moment comes, how will I react? Will I be brave and courageous, or will I fail? And we can never know how we're going to react in that moment. And now he said, finally, I am put to the test and I can see what I am made of. And he passed that test with incredible devotion. So that's one important lesson. Rabbi Akiva saw life as a mission. And he didn't see the end of life as something scary or unfortunate. This was one more step in the fulfillment of his mission. And I always feel this way, you know, people mind. It bothers them getting old. Nobody likes to get old. It's this incredible phenomenon that we have. Nobody wants to get old, you know. I am going to be turning 40 this summer. And to some of you, that may seem very young, but to my kids, ladies, to my kids, this seems ancient. And they already said that for my big 40th birthday, they are going to find me a nice cane. And they are going to shape it very nicely and maybe shellac it. And they're going to be giving me a cane for my 40th birthday. Nobody likes to get old. But my feeling is that if life is a mission, then what's wrong with getting old? You know, it's like a marathon, right? Now I know people who are taking the good weather as this challenge, the couch to 5K. And I think, Alyssa, you one time engaged in this couch to 5K challenge, and you passed this amazingly well. You know, I think Alyssa is going to say something. Are you going to say something, Alyssa? No? Okay. But, you know, it's imagine somebody trains for a marathon, and the big day comes, and they're on the marathon, and they're on mile 21. Just five more to go. They're not going to be like, oh, shucks, it's almost over. Terrible. I wish this could keep going. They're going to be thrilled that they're progressing, that they're gaining. They have miles now behind them. And if life is a journey where we're meant to accomplish, and if you each think back to your own personal journey, how much you have accomplished, how much you have grown in your life, the things you've built, you've accomplished so much. Getting old is not reason for feeling sad or worried. It's a reason to feel accomplished. And that's how Rabbi Akiva saw his life. That's one important lesson I feel that's important to learn from this story. But lesson number two is as follows. The story of Rabbi Akiva goes back to a man who was a shepherd, and we're going to focus more on this story in a bit. He was a shepherd. He was illiterate. He could not distinguish the letter Aleph from the letter Bet. When did he begin his study of Torah? At what age? At my big birthday this summer, when he was 40 years old. And we'll get into the details of why, what prompted him, what inspired him to begin studying. But the bottom line is that he began to study when he was just 40 years old. And that's my little daughter in the background. She's 2.5, and she's just amazing. She's great. She got this bike, and we got training wheels, and now she zooms around town. And she, of course, on these walks that we take as a family, to just to get out a little bit, get some fresh air. But anyway, he was 40 years old when he first began to study. And there are many people who feel perhaps that they've already grown old. You know, I can't ever make anything of myself. I'm already old. I'm already 40. Like, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, they say. And perhaps Rabbi Akiva could feel at the very end now that he had wasted so many years. 40 years went by of illiteracy. Forget about scholarship and erudition, but he was illiterate for 40 years. And perhaps that feeling of just having lost those years would weigh on him at the end, where he would feel sad because his life, he didn't make the most of it. He had forfeited 40 years. He didn't feel sad about that. He focused on his triumphs, on his accomplishments, and not on his failings. Focused on what he had and not what he didn't. And that's what allowed him to leave this world with this sense of calm, serenity, clarity. And he just felt that he had accomplished so much, and he looked at what he could accomplish and not what he failed to. And that's what gave him this strength. I feel that the life of Rabbi Akiva is one that is punctuated with always focusing on the positive. And just to share with you a few more anecdotes in the Talmud, where it tells us that Rabbi Akiva was always focused on the positive. A very famous story, and this is found at the end of Tractate Makot. And it tells us a story. This is the last snippet of Talmud in that tractate. And it says as follows. There was an occasion right after the temple, the second temple was destroyed, where the sages were going for a walk. And they arrived at a place called Mount Scopus. In Hebrew, it's called Har HaTzofim, which has an incredible vantage point of the Temple Mount. Mount Scopus, because you could scope out the entire surrounding areas from this mountain. And when they arrived at Mount Scopus, they saw the site upon which the temple once stood. They rent their garments. They tore their clothes in mourning, in keeping with the halachic practice of mourning. And when they arrived at the Temple Mount, they saw a fox that emerged from the site where the Holy of Holies, the most sacred inner sanctum, once stood, where the high priest himself only entered once a year. And they began weeping. But Rabbi Akiva, this great sage, was laughing. He was mirthful. And they said to him, "What's the reason? Why are you laughing? This is such a tragic sight to behold." And Rabbi Akiva said to them, "Why are you weeping?" And they said, "Well, the reason why we're weeping is quite obvious, because concerning the place about which scripture writes, and a foreigner who approaches shall die, that means anyone who would not be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, if they were to enter that place, they would die. And now we see foxes wandering around. Is that not reason to weep?" And Rabbi Akiva says, "I'll share with you why I am laughing, why I feel joy. Because it is written as follows. In the book of Isaiah, it says the following verse. And I, God, will take to me faithful witnesses to attest. And they are Uriah, the priest, and Zechariah." And the Talmud asks, what are the connection? What's the connection between these two men, between Uriah and Zechariah? One was a prophet during the first temple era, and the other was a prophet during the second temple era. There seems to be no connection. And the Talmud goes on to explain that each of these men prophesied. One of them spoke about the destruction, the complete and total destruction of Zion. And Uriah writes, therefore, for your sake, Zion shall be plowed as a field to complete rubble and devastation. But Zechariah spoke of a very happy prophecy. He spoke as follows, that one day, the old and the young, there shall be elderly men and elderly women sitting in the streets of Jerusalem with the boisterous noise of young children playing in the streets, confidently living there. Again, normal family life resumed. These two prophecies of Uriah and of Zechariah, one speaking of destruction and the other speaking of complete rebuilding of Jewish civilization in the Holy Land. And the Talmud explains that one prophecy is contingent upon the other. And says Rabbi Akiva, if I see the fulfillment of the first, if I see the Temple Mount plowed in ruins with foxes running around, I know with certainty that the second prophecy of rebuilding, of restoration, that prophecy will also come true. And that's why I feel hope. That is why I feel joy. That's why I'm laughing. And that is the story of Rabbi Akiva. Always able to see the positive despite the devastation and destruction, he was able to focus on the positive. Even as he was being killed, he was able to say, "Ah, finally I'm able to fulfill a verse that I always wished I was able to fulfill." There's another very famous story in the Talmud about Rabbi Akiva. And this one speaks particularly to his ability to see the positive. And this story is found in the Talmud, in the Tractate of Brachot, page 60. And it says as follows. It says that Rabbi Akiva was very much practiced. He was accustomed to saying the following line, everything that the Almighty does, the Merciful One does, he does for the best. Ko nilsa de Ovid Rachmano, everything that the Merciful One does, letav Ovid, he does for the best. And the Talmud goes on to tell a story how one time Rabbi Akiva was traveling, and he was traveling on his donkey. That was his mode of transportation. And he always traveled with a rooster so that in the morning he would have the ability to wake up. The rooster would tell people when it was time to get up in the morning. There's actually a blessing we say every single morning that we thank God for giving the rooster the intellect to distinguish between night and day. Hanosein lasech vivina lahavchin bein yom uvein loyla. You, God, gave the rooster the ability to distinguish between night and day. And that was really important. I mean, people could get up in the morning, the crack of dawn. He wanted to maximize his day, early to rise. And he also traveled with a candle, so that even after the sun would set, he would have the ability to continue his studies. And one day Rabbi Akiva was traveling, and he comes to a village, and he asks for hospitality, that perhaps an inn could put him up, and they all slam their doors rather rudely, and they say, no, we have no vacancies, despite the fact that there are obviously rooms open. And then he says, well, if none of the inns will let me in, perhaps some of the locals will show me kindness and give me a room for lodging for the night. I was just listening to a lecture about how room and board, where the phrase room and board came from. And it came from the fact that whenever you had an inn, there would be this open room, and they would place a board on everyone's knees, and they would place a wooden board, and that's how they would eat their dinner. That was the table. Before they actually had a table with legs, they would place the board on people's knees. So they gave you room, a place to sleep, and board. You would place the board on your knees, and that's how you would eat. You know, that's where the phrase room and board comes from. So Rabbi Akiva asked for room and board, and they said, no, we're sorry, you cannot stay here. Left with no choice, he went out into the forest, and he spent the night. And he settles down to go to sleep. And as he's about to fall asleep, a wind comes and extinguishes his candle. He is plunged into complete darkness. And then he hears this loud roar and a donkey, you know, just neighing and braying loudly. And the donkey is devoured by a lion. And then a few hours later, a bobcat, a wild cat, consumes his rooster. And every time one of these misfortunes befell him, Rabbi Akiva would say, everything the Almighty does, he does for the best. In the morning, he gets up and he goes to the village. And he sees that during the night, it had been ransacked by pillagers, by marauders, who abused and brutalized many of the residents. Some of them had been killed. And Rabbi Akiva realizes that if they gave him lodging, he too would have been victim to those bandits. And he realizes as well that if his flame was visible in the forest, they may have come and attacked him. I had an incredibly powerful experience. I went on a trip to Kentucky. And in Kentucky, in a place called Bowling Green, Kentucky, they have the largest underground cave system in this country called the Mammoth Caves. And we went into the depths of these caves as well, right? And it's a really cool experience. I think that John was with us on that trip to Bowling Green, Kentucky. John Horton was with us on this trip. And we go into the cave, and there are lights along the walls. And then the fellow leading the tour says, I want to show you something really cool. Are you guys ready for darkness? And he hits the button, he hits the switch, and we experience complete darkness. You can't see your hand in front of your eyes. And then he strikes a match and he lights one candle, just one candle. And the room was hundreds of feet by hundreds of feet square. And it lights up the entire room. And of course, I take the message that a little bit of light has the power to dispel tremendous darkness in this world. If you ever think, well, little me, what am I worth? And what's the good deed that I'm doing worth? A little bit of light has so much power. But just, you know, in the story of Rabbi Akiva, I always wonder, come on, are you going to see a little candle in the forest? They very well may have. A little candle in complete darkness makes such a difference. And then he realizes as well that if they heard the sounds of his donkey or of his rooster, they may have discovered him and attacked him. And everything that God did was for his protection to save him. Okay, I want to close with the following. The reason why I speak to you of Rabbi Akiva now is because we are now in a time of mourning for the students of Rabbi Akiva. There were 24,000 students, the Talmud says, that died during the time period between Passover and Shavuos. And we mourn the loss of these great students. The reason why they died, says the Talmud, was because they did not treat each other with proper respect. Shelo nahagu kavod. They didn't give honor. Kavod is honor. They didn't give honor to one another. And therefore, they all died during this time period. Just an aside, people have wondered, you know, doesn't that seem a little bit harsh? 24,000 scholars who dedicated their lives to the study of Torah. These were students who were worthy of being students of the greatest sage of their time. And they would spend hours dedicated to study. Why would they die? Because they didn't give proper honor? You know, I'm sure whatever it was incredibly subtle. All right, I am getting a message. I'm getting a message. It's a private message sent just to me. And somebody said they want to see that two-year-old who was on the microphone before. And I will. Before we close, I will bring my daughter to come say hello. And she will be very happy to come say hello because she loves going on the computer screen. But before we do that, I'm going to just share this final thought with you. So, a thought on why they would die is that in the transmission of Torah, and these were people that were meant to be a chain in that transmission, it had to be transmitted by the purest, by people who were not only of great intellectual wisdom, but of sterling character. Because in Jewish thought, when we really value and respect someone as a sage, it's not just for scholarship and for intellectual accomplishment and erudition. They need to be somebody of perfect character as well. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah in the Ethics of Our Fathers says that there are 49 ways, 48 ways that a person is meant to perfect their character in order to master the study of Torah. And to study Torah, you can't just be a scholar who is of moral ineptitude. You have to be a scholar who is somebody who also is developed as a person. And therefore, we're meant during this time period, there's 49 steps, 48 steps. There's supposed to be 48 days that were meant to work on our character. And if they were flawed in their character, they could not be the ones to pass on the tradition. And that's why they died. But there's one day during these 49 days, which is a day that is reserved for joyous celebration. And that is known as Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. We listen to music, we get married, we are just so happy, we build bonfires. And the question is, what happened on this Lag BaOmer that we're so ecstatic about? And our tradition teaches us that on the 33rd day of the Omer, the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. And that's why we celebrate. We celebrate the fact that on this 33rd day of the Omer, the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying. And I want to ask you the following question. Why did the students of Rabbi Akiva stop dying on the 33rd day of the Omer? And the answer is, the reason why they stopped dying was because there were none of them left. All 24,000 students died. Perhaps you'll say, well, maybe there were some that were left. I'll read to you the transcript from the Talmud. And it says as follows. Bear with me for a moment, please. Is as follows. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs. I read to you from the Talmud, the Tractate Yevamos, page 62. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs, 24,000 students, and they all died during this stretch because they didn't give each other proper respect. The world was desolate of Torah until Rabbi Akiva came to our rabbis in the south and he taught them Torah. This second group of disciples consisted of Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Elazar. And you see from there, these were the only five. These were the only five. They were a new crop. The first set, all 24,000 died. The reason why the students of Rabbi Akiva stopped dying was because there were none of them left to die. So I just want to, you know, put that into perspective. Imagine somebody was very wealthy. And he had tremendous investments, liquid assets in his bank account. And one day his fortunes turn. And every day he's looking at his investments and he's losing more and more money every single day. Until finally he checks his investments, nothing left. A bank account, it says zero. And he says, ah, finally, I didn't lose any money today. I didn't lose anything, right? We're going to say, you fool. The reason why you didn't lose any money is because you've lost it all already. There's nothing left to lose. So the question is, why is Lag BaOmer a reason for celebration? Because the students stopped dying. The reason why they stopped dying was because they were all gone. Why do we celebrate on Lag BaOmer? And in answering that question, I want to go back to the origins of Rabbi Akiva. We said that he was an illiterate shepherd at the age of 40. What happened to that man? And what happened to him was as follows. He was a shepherd for the wealthiest Jewish man alive, a man named Kalba Savua. And Kalba Savua had a daughter named Rachel or Rachel. And Rachel every day would go and she would watch this shepherd tend to the sheep in a loving, nurturing way. And she saw something. She saw something deep in this man that was sterling, that was pure. And she struck up a conversation with him. And she said, Akiva the Shepherd, I see something in you that I see in nobody else. And I would agree to marry you. But I would need you to commit yourself to study Torah. On that condition, if you dedicate yourself to the study of Torah, I will agree to marry you. Rabbi Akiva was 40. The study of Torah seemed like it was something reserved for other people, not for him. He couldn't even read, let alone study. And he went on a walk to contemplate the matter, and he comes to a little brook of streaming water. And he sees there next to the water a stone, and through the center of the stone was bored a perfectly smooth hole. And he wonders how a hole came to pierce its way through the center of the stone. And he looks up, and he sees a constant drip of water that for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have been dripping on that stone. And it made a hole through the stone. And he says to himself, if water, which is a very soft substance, could pierce through stone, which is hard, then certainly Torah, which is so incredibly strong, that will be able to make an impression on my heart that's mere flesh and blood. And he comes back to Rachel and he says, you have a deal. And they make this agreement, just amongst themselves. A few days later, Rachel's father, Kalba Savua, says, you know, Rachel, the time has come for you to find a husband. I am going to introduce you to some of the greatest scholars of our generation. And she says, you know, Dad, I think I already found somebody. And he says, really? Who may that be? And she says, well, there's a man named Akiva who I would like to marry. And he says, whoa, Akiva. You know, I don't know any scholars by that name. I'm very familiar. I've been frequenting the study halls and trying to look at different prospects for you. I don't know any scholars by the name of Akiva. She says, well, I don't think you're going to find him in the study hall. And he says, well, where may I find him? She says, you know that shepherd that you have who tends to your flock? His name is Akiva. And he says, what? That ignoramus, that man? My daughter? She's not going to marry that man. And Rachel says, you know, I've made up my mind. I think that is the perfect match for me. That's the man I want to marry. And he realizes that his daughter is resolute. She's determined. And he says, let me make one thing clear. If you marry that man, if you throw away your life for that shepherd, you will not see a penny of mine. I will disinherit you. You will live your life as a pauper. And she says, so be it. And she marries Akiva. And she sends him off to study for 12 years. After 12 years, and just imagine this. Imagine this for a moment. You don't start off when you can't read in the scholar's class. They're going to put you in the first grade if you're lucky. And he says, he sits next to six-year-old children who are more proficient at reading than he. And he's undeterred. And he's unabashed. Many people will be very self-conscious in that. And he learns, and he applies himself. After 12 years of climbing from the bottom, he established himself as a teacher, and it was a slow process. It was a painful process, I'm sure. After 12 years, he has many students, and he comes back with his students. And as he's coming back into town, he sees his wife engaged in a conversation with another woman. And the other woman says, that good-for-nothing husband of yours, leaving you like this in this hut, squalid conditions. If he was a man, he would stay here and take care of you. And he hears his wife from a distance saying, you know what? I am so proud that my husband has applied himself for these 12 years. If it would be up to me, I wish he would spend another 12. So that's exactly what Rabbi Akiva does. He goes back to the study hall and he comes back 12 years later with 24,000 students this time. And throngs of people have heard of this renowned sage who's going to be visiting their town. They don't realize that it's the hometown where his own family lives. And as he's coming, his wife realizes this was her husband. And she's trying to get close to that center. And perhaps people are kind of just boxing her out. And Rabbi Akiva says, stop. That woman, let her come close. And she comes close to the center of the throngs of people that are trying to surround him. And he says to his student, this is my wife. It's because of her that everything that I have and everything you all have attained, it's because of her. and she basks in that moment, realizing that behind every great man there stands a more powerful woman. And that was the life of Rabbi Akiva. That is the wife that he had. That is the life that he built. But after he built that from the bottom up, tragedy strikes. And for whatever reason, God feels that these are not the students that are meant to carry on the tradition. They didn't treat each other with proper respect. And over a very short span of time, they begin to die. Over the course of 32 days, 24,000 students die. I did the math. It's almost 700 funerals a day that Rabbi Akiva was involved with. You can just imagine him running from visiting the sick to attending funerals, to trying to comfort the widows and the orphans of his deceased students, until finally, all goes quiet. And the reason why it goes quiet is because they're all gone. And many people, most people, would just give up at that point. You know, it's one thing to be born into a life of privilege, of scholarship. It's another thing to climb there with blood and with sweat. And when you finally get there, you get knocked down. And you have less, you feel like you have less than you started with at the very beginning. Most people would give up at that point. But Rabbi Akiva didn't. He traveled to the south. And he found five more students. And he continued on the tradition of Torah with those five students. And through that, we have all of the Talmud, all of the Mishnah, all of the Torah that we study today is because of this great sage. On Lag BaOmer, we're not just celebrating the fact that the students stopped dying because there would be no reason to celebrate that. They stopped dying because they were gone. But we're celebrating that despite the fact that they stopped dying because there were no more, Rabbi Akiva didn't give up. A lesser man would have thrown in the towel and gone home. He did not give up. He was undeterred. He dusted off his clothing and he stood up despite the fact that he had fallen. And he said, I must go on. There is always hope. So long as there is breath in my lungs, I'm able to breathe and walk and talk, I will accomplish. I will never give up. In the book of Proverbs, written by King Solomon, the wisest of all men, it says, Kisheva yipol tzadik vikam, which means that the righteous man will fall seven times, but he will always get up. And the world sometimes thinks that the phrase means that despite the fact that the righteous man will stumble, he'll get up. It explains the great Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, of blessed memory. And it doesn't mean despite the fact that he falls, he gets up. It means due to the fact that he falls, he grows. Because a necessary step in growth is to fall. You falter, you fall, you trip, and you get up. And that builds resiliency. It teaches you which areas need to be strengthened. And it's through the growth and the stumbling that we are able to grow. And many of us have seen this. Many of us have seen this. You know, we knew survivors. Unfortunately, that generation is passing. But we all knew survivors who experienced the horrors of the Holocaust. And their entire families were murdered, some of them in front of their very own eyes. And after the war, with nothing but the tattered shirts on their backs, they came to a new country where they didn't speak the language, where they didn't have a pen.